In the wake of Imperial Japan's attack on Pearl Harbor, American men famously flooded recruiting offices across the nation to join the war effort. These stories are well documented and attested by eyewitnesses, but one part of this narrative that's left out or overlooked is that Black Americans joined with an equal level of fervor. Over 1 million Black men and women served in the war, playing crucial roles in every theater of World War II. They worked in segregated units and performed vital support jobs and also combat roles like the Tuskegee Airmen. Not everyone ran to the recruiting office, of course. This was during the Jim Crow era, and some Black Americans asked if they should risk their lives to live as what one called half American. But as the war effort grew, Black Americans increasingly enlisted as part of what newspapers called the Double V campaign, a slogan to promote the fight for democracy abroad, but also in the home front in the United States. And it was also the idea that if Black Americans wholeheartedly contributed to the war effort, it'd lead to legal and social equality. Today's guest is Matthew Delmont, author of Half American, the epic story of African Americans fighting World War II at home and abroad. It's the first ever comprehensive history of World War II to focus on Black Americans. We look at stories of people such as Thurgood Marshall, a future Supreme Court justice, and then the chief lawyer for the NAACP who investigated violence against Black troops and veterans, Benjamin O. Davis Jr., leader of the Tuskegee Airmen, who was at the forefront of the years-long fight to open the Air Force to Black pilots, and poet Langston Hughes, who worked as a war correspondent for the Black Press. Some of their greatest struggles came when they returned home. They were denied housing and education, couldn't apply for the GI Bill. On the streets of southern cities, Black soldiers were attacked just for wearing their uniforms in public. But without their contributions to the war effort, the United States couldn't have been victorious. And as Delma argues, their contributions were necessary for the civil rights movement later. Hope you enjoyed this discussion with Matthew Delma. And one more thing before we get started with this episode, a quick break for a word from our sponsors. From what I've seen about the story of integration in the armed forces of the United States, it's been a story of two steps forward, one step back, or sometimes two steps forward, three steps back. For example, there are up to 10,000 soldiers, Black soldiers, that fought in the Revolutionary War on the Patriot side. Then they're largely denied service into the armed forces. Then the Massachusetts 54th Regiment in the Civil War is an enormously successful Black infantry regiment. Then, again, forces are slowly integrated, but they're deintegrated by Woodrow Wilson. Can you give us the state of affairs of Black service opportunities in the United States prior to World War I that you think we need to keep in mind as you tell the story of the particular figures in your book?
Black Americans have served in every war that the United States has ever been a part of. I think for a lot of the same reasons that white Americans have served, that Black Americans care deeply about the country and they wanted to demonstrate both their patriotism and in many cases their manhood by serving in the military. And that period leading up to World War I is really the same story, that for Black Americans, in many cases, they saw the military as their pathway towards full citizenship and equality, and sometimes explicitly said so, that there was a kind of drumbeat saying that if we serve in World War I, even if it's in segregated units, this will be our chance to demonstrate that we should be fully part of this nation. Of course, it didn't turn out that way. You had a number of thousands of Black Americans serve in World War I. They come home and there's actually worse treatment when they get back from the war. Veterans are attacked. There's race riots in many communities. And so it's this moment where Black Americans are left questioning what it really means to serve the military of their country, that they want to do the right thing. They want to demonstrate the patriotism. But that patriotism looks different for Black Americans.
Largely speaking, when we come up to World War I or World War II enlistment in 1941, what were the different service opportunities for Black Americans in what different capacities, largely speaking, and of course, there are a number of exceptions, but what opportunities would be available to them?
So going into World War II, the service opportunities for Black Americans were really limited. All of the services were segregated, the Navy, Army. Initially, at the start of World War II, the Marine Corps didn't allow Black Marines in any capacity. Within the Navy, they only allowed Black Americans to serve in the messman branch, where they were essentially serving the needs of white officers on ships, doing cooking and cleaning, and other kind of orderly duties like that. Within the Army, they served largely in service and supply units, and they were largely blocked from combat units at the start of World War II. And to make matters worse, the Army didn't even have enough regiments or enough training camps to accommodate all the Black troops, Black Americans who wanted to serve in the military. And so opportunities were particularly limited at the start of the war. Those start to expand over the course of World War II. largely through organized efforts on behalf of Black civil rights activists, the Black press, these key Black newspapers like the Pittsburgh Courier, and then by the important roles that Black Americans are playing in the military. There's a recognition that these men and women can do the job, and that starts to open up a few more opportunities over the course of the war.
A story that I've heard many times from guests on this podcast about the motivations for recruitment in World War II is that after Pearl Harbor happens, millions of young men are running to recruitment offices, flooding them, desperate to serve. And it can sound a little bit like an idealized version of the past, but then when I've talked to actual World War II vets, they say the same thing. And I really don't have any reason to disbelieve it. It sounds like in the wake of 9/11, where the nation comes together radically, there are millions want to donate, many want to serve. And for Black Americans, those who do serve are not small numbers by any means. 1 million serve. And how would you describe the motivations among those who do want to serve? I'm sure there are many different versions of the story, but from what you looked into, what happens after Pearl Harbor? What do different Black Americans think?
Pearl Harbor was certainly important for Black Americans as well. I mean, it's hard to overstate how large of an impact that had on the country. It's on every radio station, it's on every newspaper, and it really galvanizes the country. This is the moment that the U.S. is now going to officially enter World War II. And so you find the same kind of stories from Black Americans going to recruiting offices immediately after Pearl Harbor to volunteer for service. What's different about Black Americans is that in many cases, they were actually turned away at those recruiting offices because they didn't yet have enough units to be able to accommodate the Black troops. The other thing that's different for Black Americans, though, is that Pearl Harbor really made official something that Black Americans really already knew had been coming for a number of years. So if you looked at Black newspapers over the course of the 1930s, they were following the development of the war in Europe very, very closely. So as early as 1933, you see articles about Hitler's rise and the rise of Nazi Germany and how much of a threat that's going to pose not only to Europe, but really to the world. I think the reason Black newspapers were so on top of that issue is that they saw real clear commonalities between the racial ideology of Nazi Germany and what Black Americans were experiencing in the United States. The kind of Jim Crow segregation they encountered in the South, the kind of police brutality, the lynchings, the discrimination in terms of riding on railroad cars and housing. They made these connections explicit, and they were very clear that the Nazis were in many cases drawing explicitly from a Jim Crow playbook. So throughout the 1930s, there are numerous articles that talk about how, you know, this world war is developing in Europe, but it's going to come to the United States sooner rather than later. And so by the time Pearl Harbor happens, Black Americans are already kind of primed for this conflict. The other thing that's different with Black Americans is that they're particularly interested in how Nazi Germany and the Axis powers, especially Italy, are fighting Black nations. So Italy's invasion of Ethiopia in 1935 was, for a lot of Black Americans, the official start of World War II. Ethiopia at that point was the lone independent nation of Africa. And they, for Black Americans, they saw that as an affront. They saw this as a white nation, Italy, attacking an independent Black nation that they had a strong affiliation with. And so between that, between the Spanish Civil War in 1936, 1937, that at least 80 Black Americans went and fought in, there are countless examples of Black Americans paying attention to the war and in really wanting to play a role in securing freedom and democracy globally before Pearl Harbor.
I suppose it's worth introducing one figure in your book because he promotes what he calls the Double Victory Campaign. Can you discuss briefly James Thompson and what is the Double Victory Campaign? Because I think this is good to keep in mind as we consider different people who get involved in the war effort in different capacities.
James Thompson was a 26-year-old cafeteria worker from Wichita, Kansas. And after Pearl Harbor, when he knows he's going to be drafted like most other Black men of that age, he writes a letter to the Pittsburgh Courier, which is one of the most important Black newspapers of the era. And in his letter, he says, "Should I give my life to live half American?" And that's where the title for my book comes from. He says, "Should I give my life to live half American?" And he goes on to ask, "What does it mean to serve my country in a segregated military, knowing that I might come back to a country in which I still might not be a full citizen?" What he ends up writing is that, you know, if we're going to fight this war, we need to have not only victory over fascism abroad, not only victory on the battlefield against the Nazis, but we need to have victory over racism at home. And so that becomes the Double Victory Campaign, these two victories, victory over fascism abroad and victory over racism at home. The Pittsburgh Courier takes Thompson's letter and broadcasts it, prints it nationally, writes dozens of editorials and articles and editorial cartoons, and really rallies behind this idea of double victory. And it becomes the framework for which African-Americans understand the war effort. It's the rallying cry for African-Americans during the war. And it's important because it really puts a clear focus on what the war meant for Black Americans, that yes, they absolutely wanted to secure military victory over Germany, Japan, and the Axis forces, but that was only half the battle. It wasn't enough to secure victory just on the military battlefield, but you had to be able to come home and actually have democracy and freedom at home. You had to be a full citizen. That was the other half of the battle. And that double victory campaign was important during the war, but also then helped fuel the kind of civil rights activism that you saw after the war. And so James Thompson really sets all of this in motion with his letter to the Pittsburgh Courier, and then the newspaper broadcasts it or sends it out nationally. And it really has a galvanizing impact on Black Americans during the war.
Based on the archives that you looked at and the accounts that you read, this concept of double victory, how much of this was in the minds of an average Black enlistee? Was this widely known? Was this known by those who were following the Black press? Or what do you see in the accounts that you saw?
In the accounts that I've seen, it was very widely known, in part because Black newspapers reached into every corner of Black society at this time. You could find copies, not just on newsstands, but in bars and beauty parlors and churches. And an average Black American in Cleveland, Chicago, in Texas, Florida, they would have come in contact with either the Pittsburgh Courier or with their local Black newspaper that would have carried something about the Double Victory campaign. There were Double Victory clubs that formed in communities all over the country. And so for average Black troops among the million who served, the vast, vast majority would have known about the Double Victory campaign. And one of the reasons the Double Victory campaign and that slogan was so powerful was because it wasn't necessarily a new idea. It was something that had been part of African American history for a long time. Going back to the Civil War, Frederick Douglass says very similar things about the importance of not just winning the war, but actually securing real meaningful freedom and citizenship. During World War I, W.E.B. Du Bois says something similar about not just winning the military aspect of the battle, but actually being able to come home and have the right to vote, have the right to live without fear of your personal safety. And so for Black Americans who were serving in World War II, this is something the Double Victory campaign would have resonated with, things that they would have heard from their parents and their grandparents. It would have resonated with their own personal experiences of facing discrimination, both in the United States, but then facing racism and discrimination once they deployed to these foreign battlefields. And so it was absolutely something that was central to the experience of the majority of Black troops.
That's helpful to know as we consider the challenges of those who enlist in the military, the discrimination they face, and we're thinking about what is motivating them beyond the typical motivations of any soldier fighting the war. One other sort of look at the broad sweep of experience of these troops before we get into particular individual profiles. What were challenges and the forms of segregation that Black enlistees faced in military training camps?
So for a lot of Black troops, their experience of military training camps, which were primarily located in the South, was really demoralizing. For troops who came from the Midwest or North or the West Coast, they would ride trains to these Southern camps. And while they would have experienced racism and discrimination in their hometowns, they hadn't experienced anything with the kind of vitriol of Jim Crow segregation in the South. And so they would tell stories about riding these trains, and they had to switch to Jim Crow cars, to segregated cars, once they reached Washington, D.C. or a Southern point. When they pulled in these Southern towns, they told stories about having to pull the shades down so that white townspeople wouldn't throw rocks at the trains. And they're wearing their military uniforms at this point. And so in theory, the military uniform is meant to be the thing that unifies the troops. It's something that the uniform is the same, whether it's worn by a white American or Black American, but they weren't treated the same. They weren't regarded with the same amount of respect that white soldiers were. And once they were at these military training camps, they experienced racism and discrimination both on base from their officers and white enlistees and draftees, but then also when they had recreation time and were able to go into town, they were harassed by local police, by local sheriffs, by civilians who were deputized as police. In some cases, they were threatened or shot at in streetcars if they didn't move to the back of a streetcar or back of a bus. And so the story that a lot of Black troops told was that they were eager to deploy to Europe or the Pacific because they thought they would actually be safer if they're actually in combat rather than facing the kind of racism and violence they encountered on these military bases and in the surrounding towns in the U.S. South.
Right. This is the irony of ironies, that they're going into combat and they could face better treatment. Thinking, I don't know how much this relates to your story, but Jesse Owens' account in 1930s Nazi Germany, that he's given much better treatment by some of his German competitors than he does by his American teammates, and not being invited into the Roosevelt White House after winning the gold medal. One of the better known accounts among Black soldiers in World War II are the Tuskegee Airmen. Can you tell me about the experiences of Benjamin Davis and his efforts to open up the Air Force to Black pilots?
So Benjamin O. Davis Jr. was the first Black graduate from the U.S. Military Academy at West Point in the 20th century. He was only the fourth graduate overall. When he graduates in 1936, the Army really has no idea what to do with him because they don't have a set of roles in place for Black officers. His father's actually an officer, and so he has as much military pedigree as almost any white American at the time. But the handful of Black officers who do exist are largely in teaching capacities at Black colleges, training other Black college students who are going to go on to serve roles in the military. And so when Benjamin O. Davis Jr. graduates, he desperately wants to be a pilot. But at that time, the Air Corps, which is still part of the Army, they're not allowing any Black pilots. And even worse, there's not really any role for a Black officer to have. In large part due to the kind of protests that are waged by the Black press and other civil rights activists, by 1940, 1941, the Army finally decides to start an experiment for Black pilots at Tuskegee Air Base in Alabama. There's some discussion about whether it should be an integrated air base in some place like Chicago or whether it's going to be segregated. And they end up going with a segregated air base in Tuskegee, Alabama. And Benjamin O. Davis Jr. is tapped as the leader of this first cohort of Tuskegee Airmen. So he's one of five cadets who make it through training, and he's the first leader of the Tuskegee Airmen. And his experience in those years from when he graduates West Point in 1936 to when he makes it through training in 1942 really encapsulates a huge amount. It's really a microcosm of the experiences of other Black Americans at the time, that he desperately wants to defend his country. He is about as prototypical of American as you could be. But because of his skin color, he's denied these opportunities. He's got a degree from West Point. He's an appointed officer, but the military, the Army doesn't really know what to do with him at the time. But those opportunities change pretty rapidly from 1936 to 1942. So with the Tuskegee Airmen, he's able to get his foot in the door and really get the open doors for Black Americans in the Army Air Corps. That continues to come with fits and starts. And so even after these first waves of cadets are trained, the Army still is reluctant to send them off into combat. And so the Tuskegee Airmen spend most of their time flying training missions week after week, month after month in Alabama while they see white pilots being deployed much more quickly with much less training than they have. By 1943, the Tuskegee Airmen finally have a chance to go into combat, and they really distinguish themselves. They take on the roles that they're tasked with, which are largely support roles at the time, flying alongside bombers, defending the bombers, but they do everything that's asked of them. But even still, then there's a set of press articles that come out that attack them and say that they don't have the courage or the instincts to be the kind of fighter pilots that the U.S. needs. And so for Benjamin Davis, this experience it's like whiplash. He takes one step forward and two steps back and doing everything he can to try to not just prove himself as a pilot, but really to open opportunities for other Black Americans to fly in combat and to serve in combat for the U.S. military.
Hey everyone, Scott here. We're going to take a short break for a word from our sponsors. What was your impression reading their accounts? Because from what I know from some Tuskegee Airmen, one Lieutenant Colonel Harry Stewart mentioning there's this double pressure, as you mentioned, the double victory campaign. You have the pressure of being a fighter pilot when you could die at any given moment. So that's already enormous. On the other hand, you have the pressure of we are the test case of possibly the full integration of the armed forces. Our nation is looking at us to see if the claim that Black pilots, Black soldiers are every bit as capable as white soldiers is true or not. And we have to prove that. What was your impression when you're reading the accounts of these people and they have that kind of pressure on them?
It's a huge amount of pressure, and it's something that it wasn't shared. That experience just wasn't shared by white pilots or by white troops in combat. That for these Black pilots and the Tuskegee Airmen, they absolutely believed and understood that if they failed, not only were they failing as individuals in their mission, but there was a potential that Black Americans might not be allowed in the Air Corps for another generation, that they felt that kind of weight on their shoulders. And to make matters worse, in some cases, their commanding officers, their white commanding officers, they knew that they didn't respect them or that they wanted to see them fail. There was one of their first officers who would play petty tricks on the Tuskegee Airmen. He would schedule meetings and then tell them the wrong time to show up, so they would show up late to it. Or his after-action reports would disparage the pilots and say that they weren't doing as good of a job as they could. it was a hard thing for them to experience. And it's a hard thing as a historian to have to read, that you would want to believe that in the Air Corps, in the military, that all Americans were on the same side. But the reality is that just wasn't true, that you had some white commanders in the Air Corps who just weren't ready yet for black pilots. And that makes the achievements of the Tuskegee Airmen all the more impressive, that they weren't just fighting the Nazis in the air, they weren't just at war, but they're also trying to prove themselves and to show their fellow countrymen that they could do this. And the fact that they did really did help open up not just the Air Corps, but it was a part of the large effort to desegregate the military after the war.
Something that you do in your book is focus on the roles of those who are not what we traditionally think of as soldiers, but are part of this much larger war effort that goes beyond the battlefield. There are many people to look at. I'd like to focus on one person, a war correspondent, Langston Hughes. Can you tell me about him and the effect that he had on the black press?
I think most listeners are probably familiar with Langston Hughes, the famous African-American poet and writer. One thing people might not realize is that he was a war correspondent in the 1930s, that he traveled to Spain during the Spanish Civil War to report on a group of black Americans who had joined the Abraham Lincoln Brigade. There were about 80 black Americans who joined this group of volunteers who went to fight against General Franco's fascist forces in Spain. And the reason they chose to take up that fight was that they believed that what was happening in Europe was going to have a direct impact, not just on the United States, but on African Americans as well. And Langston Hughes was just fascinated by this story. That's why he went to tell the stories of these black men and women who traveled to Spain. And what was important about Hughes is that he really brought the Spanish Civil War home to black Americans. He was a war correspondent for the African American, and he wrote nearly 24 dispatches from the front. And a lot of these were profiles of individual black soldiers or nurses who served in the Spanish Civil War. And one of the things that was important about that service is that they were serving in integrated units of volunteers. And so there again, there's an irony here that at the same time, these volunteers couldn't serve in integrated units in the US military, they're serving in combat units, integrated combat units in Spain. And so Hughes just does a brilliant, beautiful job of bringing those stories to life for black readers. And it's through his pen that black Americans all across the country really come to understand not just the Spanish Civil War, but how it's a prelude to World War II to follow. I think the other thing that's important about some of those Spanish Civil War volunteers that Hughes profiles is that many of them went on to fight during World War II. So one person was Edgar Allan Carter Jr., who was in the Spanish Civil War, who ends up serving in the Army in World War II and earns Medal of Honor posthumously. It's, a case where black Americans demonstrated valor throughout the war, but in many cases, that valor wasn't recognized until decades later. And Hughes played a really important role alongside other war correspondents in bringing the war to life for black readers.
Another person who is working outside of the military and is operating on the home front is Ella Baker. She's advocating for black soldiers and veterans and their families. Can you tell me what she did and what did her efforts look like?
So Ella Baker is a really important grassroots activist. She was one of the kind of pioneering figures who proposed a model of leadership where everyday people could be important leaders. It didn't just need to be people with college educations or business leaders or lawyers to be community leaders or activists, but everyday people without formal education could be really important leaders for their communities. She travels throughout the Midwest and Mid-Atlantic and South doing training sessions for black communities on these sort of leadership techniques and tactics, how to organize your community to fight for what you need, whether that's housing, whether it's voting. She provides tools that helps these communities grow stronger. She does this not only during World War II, but she has a huge influence during the 1960s. And in many ways, her leadership model influenced the kind of Black Lives Matter protests we saw just a couple of years ago. But during World War II, she understands that black soldiers are drawn from these everyday communities across black America. And so she, at that point, is a field representative for the NAACP, which is the largest civil rights group at the time. And her job is to help to sign up new chapter branches and new members. And she's really successful at it. She goes across the United States, signing up new members and getting new chapters organized, and gives them the tools they need to be able to sustain those chapters once she leaves. That gives the NAACP more resources through more dues-paying members. It gives them more resources to be able to advocate on behalf of black soldiers. And one of my favorite things that I found in doing the research was there were black units that were deployed in whether it was Normandy or other parts of Europe or in the Pacific, who would essentially pass around the hat, pass around their helmet, and chip in whatever money that they had to be able to send back to the NAACP. I think that's probably the clearest demonstration we have of the Double Victory campaign, that these Black troops were literally on war fronts raising money for the civil rights battle at home. And I think what's particularly important for about Ella Baker in the context of this kind of military history is that one of the things that was so powerful about her vision of leadership is that it meant that almost any person, any everyday person could be a leader. That went directly against the kind of leadership philosophies of the U.S. military at the time, which was explicit in believing that the Black Americans lacked the intelligence, courage, and vision to be leaders. Ella Baker really successfully demonstrated that that was false, and through that really laid the foundation for the kind of civil rights organizing that took place, not just immediately after the war, but really in the several decades to follow.
Right. And speaking of the NAACP, there's an element of activism here that it's understood it's not just that World War II is won, but that peace is also won as well. And if we speak very broadly about World War II, one thing that post-war planners got right that post-World War I planners did not get right was engineering a successful peace. So there was a stable global order through institutions like the United Nations that prevented another outbreak of war a few decades later that was not successfully set up in World War I. And then coming down to the particular efforts of civil rights activists, that there's an understanding it's not enough that Black soldiers are involved in the war effort, but how does this open the door to peace afterwards? And not only that, but was justice achieved during the war effort? And if it wasn't achieved against Black soldiers, is that remedied? And can you tell me about Thurgood Marshall's efforts and what he does from a legal standpoint regarding what happened during World War II?
So Thurgood Marshall is probably best known as the first Black U.S. Supreme Court justice, but during the war, the lion's share of his time was dedicated to fighting legal battles on behalf of Black troops. So at this point in time, being a civil rights lawyer really was not a desk job. Thurgood Marshall traveled thousands of miles every year, going from small town to small town, investigating these cases of violence and harassment against Black troops and against Black civilians. He was particularly important in trying to call attention to violence in a couple of the Southern Army bases. He received testimonials from the troops who had been attacked or been threatened by white townspeople, and worked with his mentor, William Hasty, who was an advisor to the Secretary of the Army, to try to make sure that these got dealt with. The scope of the problems, the magnitude of problems, was massive, but Thurgood Marshall was persistent in trying to make sure that these were something that couldn't be swept under the rug, that they received national attention and that the military was forced to address them. Later in the war, he plays an important role in trying to help a group of Black sailors who are charged with mutiny at Port Chicago. There's a terrible explosion in the West Coast, Port Chicago, that kills more than 200 Black sailors who are loading cargo ships there. When a number of the surviving sailors refuse to go back to work, they're charged with mutiny. And so Thurgood Marshall is one of the lawyers who comes to their defense, and while he's not able to get them exonerated fully, he was able to help get their sentences lightened. And so played an important role there as well. Coming out of the war, Thurgood Marshall is one of the kind of linchpins who helps to make sure that home front aspect of the Double Victory campaign remains front and center. And so at that point, he shifts a lot of his attention to voting rights cases and to the school segregation cases, in which a lot of the Black veterans are participating as well. And so tracing his kind of career through the war and into the post-war period, I think he really articulates how important civil rights activism was, both military service members to veterans and to regular Black civilians.
With the Double Victory campaign, one of the V's is achieved when the war is won. The Allies are victorious. In the immediate aftermath of the war, when servicemen return home, when other advocates on the home front are going back to their regular lives, in the weeks and months and maybe a couple of years afterwards, what are the expectations that people have as they're seeking the second V in the Double Victory campaign? And what are the struggles they have when things aren't that great when they come back to the home front?
So the end of the war and that homecoming period is probably the biggest difference in terms of how the war is experienced for Black Americans and for white Americans. For white Americans, they're understandably relieved to be finished with 4 years of brutal fighting, and they want to get back to how things were. And the kind of public polling and survey data from the time keep referring to the fact that white Americans want to return to how things were before the war. For Black Americans, that's the exact opposite of what they want. That a return to the way things were before the war means a return to Jim Crow segregation, means a return to not being able to vote, means a return to physical harassment, in some cases violence and murder, that couldn't be prosecuted in white courtrooms. And so what Black Americans are seeking is that other half of the Double Victory campaign. They're seeking an end to racism and white supremacy at home. And there's a real mismatch there that Black Americans come home wanting something that white Americans, the majority of white Americans, are not eager or willing to provide. That leads to conflicts. Black Americans are increasingly vocal in demanding full citizenship, demanding their civil rights and equal rights. And in a lot of communities, particularly in the South, these Black veterans are seen as real threats by their white countrymen. That results in violence, that there are more than a dozen cases where Black veterans were murdered or lynched, in some cases while still wearing their military uniforms, in part because they're seen as a threat to the racial order of the South. They white townspeople understand that these Black veterans and other Black citizens want full citizenship. They want an end to Jim Crow segregation. Beyond just the kind of violence that Black troops encounter, there's also policy discrimination. So the GI Bill is one of the most important pieces of legislation really in American history, but certainly in the context of World War II. It provided a path to the middle class for millions and millions of returning veterans by providing college tuition benefits, by providing small business loans, access to home mortgages. That propels a whole generation of white veterans into the middle class, but that legislation ends up being carried out in a racial discriminatory manner, that for too many Black veterans, when they try to access those benefits, because they're distributed at the local level, they go to veterans offices in the South and they're turned away, or they're given the runaround and pushed into vocational programming rather than to colleges. They can't get mortgages to live in many parts of the country. And so that kind of discrimination in terms of the GI Bill is disrespectful to Black veterans. And they said as much at the time, that they wanted the same kind of respect and warm welcome upon coming home as their white counterparts, but they didn't receive it. And that partly fueled the fire that emerged in the civil rights movement of the 1950s and 60s, that Black veterans fought for their country, they risked their lives for the country, they saw their buddies die for their country, and they were going to come home and make sure that they had full citizenship, and they were going to fight for it.
I'd like to hear at length your take on the contributions of World War II service of Black Americans to the civil rights movement. On this podcast, I've heard many different explanations of what caused the civil rights movement to happen and ultimately to succeed, at least in the 1960s framework. It didn't begin with Montgomery bus boycotts or the Freedom Riders. I mean, some of the explanations I've heard offered are Jackie Robinson, the integration of professional sports. Others have credited Hollywood. Others have credited jazz. This came from someone in the Jazz Museum in Kansas City, so he's probably a little biased toward that answer. I mean, it's an incredibly complicated phenomenon. I don't think anyone would say it's monocausal, but you're a scholar, so I know you're familiar with all these different takes on it, but what are some of the different explanations out there, and what would you say are the contributions that the involvement of Black Americans in World War II had toward the civil rights movement? Scott here. One more break for a word from our sponsors.
So as you're saying, there are numerous. And so there's no single thing that sparks the civil rights movement. And obviously the civil rights movement is initiated years before World War II. And so it's something that really takes place over the entirety of the 20th century. But if I were to point to things from World War II, I think some of the things that are important are the kind of training that Black Americans received during the war, and the kind of discipline and really courage under fire that Black Americans had, Black veterans had when they came back. They spoke to that and said this made them more comfortable and more confident to face the kind of combat-like situations they were going to have to face, particularly in the South. It gave them the understanding that these were long-term challenges that had to be faced, that it took persistence and kind of logistical training to get groups of people organized to fight these fights over years and years. A lot of them credited that to the military. I think the other thing in terms of training, Ella Baker, who I mentioned previously, that kind of grassroots organizing that she helped to instill was crucially important. I think when we think about the civil rights movement, it's important not to think just about the kind of figureheads like Martin Luther King Jr., but it was really the everyday people, particularly Black women in communities all across the country, who were the backbone or the foundation of the civil rights movement. And so that kind of training that Ella Baker instilled, coupled with the kind of military training that a lot of Black men and women received through the military, it provided a really solid base of support from which the civil rights movement could emerge. And the other thing I would point to is trying to build on successes and build on victories. And what I mean by that is the military is finally desegregated in 1948. And my story on that is usually that both a decade early and a decade late. that there's really no reason the military couldn't have been desegregated in 1938, that there's no military or strategic reason to have a segregated military. In fact, it's counterproductive strategically because they had to do everything in duplicate. They had the separate training camps for Black troops and separate latrines and cafeterias, that the military could have been desegregated in 1938. But when it gets desegregated in 1948, that still puts it ahead of every other branch of the federal government, that it's 6 years before the Brown versus Board decision that desegregates schools, and that the justices there actually look to the desegregation of the military as an example of why schools should go down the path to desegregation. And so in those years after World War II, the civil rights movement's able to build on different victories to make the case why different aspects of society need to be desegregated, why equality is important across society. And so I think it's important that the troops who served in World War II were able to demonstrate their capacities that helped to lead to the desegregation of the military in 48. That decision in 48 helps to lead to Brown versus Board in 54 and helps to lay the foundation for other civil rights advances later on in the 50s and 60s. And so I think overall, there are many different kind of threads that need to get pulled together to think about the civil rights movement. But more than anything, I think it's the training and the broad base of support that the World War II hopes to produce that helps to fuel the civil rights movement in the years afterwards.
And lastly, something I like to do on the show is connect whatever the topic is at hand to much larger questions, you know, going to the 30,000 foot view of the universal experience and looking at things in a way that my advisors would not let me do as a PhD student, or if I were writing an article for a niche academic journal that nobody would ever read. And getting back to this question of sort of the incredible pressure that figures in your book were facing, I imagine a Tuskegee Airman who's getting ready to fly on a mission as P-51 Mustang. I've seen World War II aircraft up close, and these are just like rickety buckets of bolts like any car from the 1940s would be, except these things have to fly and they're being shot at. So it's daunting to begin with as a fighter pilot, no matter what you're doing. You're preparing for a mission. Maybe you don't have as good of training or equipment as white pilots do. You know this. You're also thinking, if I don't perform well, I'm letting down my family, my community, my children who will come after me. So it's an incredible level of pressure to begin with, yet hundreds of thousands, millions of people overcome this pressure and they succeed. And talking about this sort of, you know, being able to handle this, sports psychology is a multi-million or billion-dollar industry of helping put people into the mindset of being able to achieve things under incredible pressure. Writers like Viktor Frankl have talked about man's search for meaning and having a particular purpose guiding them through incredible hardship or difficulty. Is there anything you saw, or maybe a few things you saw, that were a guiding light that helped people through a double level of hardship beyond what a typical person would have gone through when your typical serviceman or servicewoman is already facing far more hardship than I would say I've ever faced and many of the listeners here have ever faced? Is there any sort of thing that you think you saw that you think guided them through these incredible trials of hardship?
That's a great question. I don't know if there's a singular one, but I think the commonality for so many of these Black World War II veterans is that they truly believed a better country was possible in the United States. And when they thought of what it meant for them to be Black Americans, it meant, just as you're describing, that they were not only fighting military battles, but in many cases, they had to fight their own countrymen to survive in the United States, either as civilians or in the military. That's a really unique position to be put in. And it's something it's been a common experience for a lot of Black Americans throughout their history in this country. But I think what motivated them was that even given all of that, they still fought for the United States. And they did that because they believed that the country could be better than it was. I've spent a lot of time trying to sit with it and think about it. And it's moving, and I think it's profound that given everything Black Americans had encountered in the years leading up to World War II, there would have been a lot of good cases to make that they should have sat out World War II, that they shouldn't have joined or enlisted or accepted their draft status in the way that they did. But they didn't do that. They gave everything they had to the war effort and then came home and continued to fight. As one veteran put it, went from the European theater of operations to the Southern theater of operations. I think that speaks volumes to how much that generation of Black Americans cared about their country. And I think how they wanted to demand that America live up to its founding documents, that it actually provide the kind of democracy, freedom, and equality that has always claimed to be there for all Americans. They want that to be a true statement.
Well, this is a really important analysis of World War II, the most important event of the 20th century and what created our modern world. And I think it's something that needs to continue to be examined and re-examined. And your book is very helpful in doing so and understanding an important experience for Black Americans and the effects that they had on American history in their homecoming in the decades afterwards. Well, for listeners who want to check out your book and learn about this story in much greater depth, the name of it is Half American, the Epic Story of African Americans Fighting World War II at Home and Abroad. Matthew, thank you for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me, Scott. It was a pleasure talking with you.
That's all for today's episode. If you'd like to see show notes with sources, maps, links, anything else related to this episode and all my other ones as well, go to parthenonpodcast.com. That's the name of the podcast network this show is a part of, along with James Early's Key Battles of American History, Steve Guerra's Beyond the Big Screen and History of the Papacy, and other great history shows as well. If you'd like to support the show, the two easiest ways to do so are to subscribe to it on the podcast player of your choice and leave a review. The second thing is to join the membership program for History Unplugged. If you do so, you'll get completely ad-free episodes for the entire back catalog, which is about 600 episodes and growing. And all you have to do is go to patreon.com/unplug. Thanks for listening and see you next time.